Ruth Page is not resting on her laurels. She continues to be active in the Chicago dance community through her own ballet school and the Ruth Page Foundation, which offers scholarships to sponsor promising new talent. As Marge Halpern reports, at the age of 88, Page is still earning the title of Grand Dame of Chicago Dance.
One. And up. And up. Both feet.
Some 350 students follow in Ruth Page's footsteps every year, taking classes at her school of dance. Page only teaches an occasional class herself, but school director Larry Long says her unique, lively interpretations color lessons by all of the faculty. Long says he often hears Page's voice as he teaches his own classes.
I'll give an exercise, one that has certain technical and physical problems. After I've said, you know, you've got to make sure that your placement is correct and that you're moving from the center and you're doing all these things, technical things. But then I will say at the end of all that, which is very Ruth Page, and for God's sakes, don't be boring. Nothing is worse than being boring. You know, it's better to be a little bit outré and a little bit vulgar and a little bit bizarre rather than just be, you know, really proficient and very pure and just and boring. Boring.
To make sure her school is never boring, Paige lends her own spark to classes by showing up most days as a student. She takes the bar for warm-up exercises to keep in shape, though her failing health no longer allows for the more strenuous performances. Larry Long says that when Paige is in the room, everyone dances that extra mile. He strives to impress, too, even after working with Paige for 30 years.
Yes, I always make a more special effort. I always try to make a special effort, but somehow when Ruth is around, you always try to do a bit more. I don't want to be boring when I don't want to give a boring class when Ruth's around. And I surely don't want to give a boring class when Ruth's in it.
It's not that Paige demands an extra effort from teachers or students. Her mere presence seems to inspire each dancer to do his or her best.
It's kind of exciting because she's like really old and she'll come and she'll take bar and it's just neat that she can still come and walk around when she's that old.
I should be so lucky to be doing anything that approaches what she's doing at her age. It amazes me.
Ruth just has to walk in and into the building and everyone is aware that she's here. The little children, they all come up to her and they say, "Hello, Miss Page," and they give her a kiss and she, you know, leans over and gives them a kiss. They love her.
Teacher Warren Conover says it's easy to love Ruth Page. Students never forget she's a star, but she never seems to remember. And each student has a story to show how Page's easygoing jokes make her seem like just another dancer.
She said something funny to Warren one time. He demonstrated an exercise of some sort, and she looked, you know, sort of perplexed or something, and he said, can you see me? She said, "Oh, yes, I can see you, dear. You look beautiful." You know, something like that.
Oh, I remember one day coming up the stairs behind her and asking her how she was, and she said, "Well, I'm here." She said, "If I can make it to the school, I can make it up the stairs. If I can make it up the stairs, then I can make it through class."
The students appreciate Paige for more than her sense of humor. They understand that her commitment to Chicago dance is slowly but surely upgrading their second city status and increasing their job opportunities. Paige's production of the Nutcracker Suite each December is Chicago's largest ballet of the year, employing more dancers than any other show and paying union scale. Paige also supports and promotes local dance companies. Claire Bataille dances with Chicago's Hubbard Street Dance Company.
She's been a fan of ours from the very beginning when we were very small and is always present at our performances and has hosted some real nice receptions for us. It's great. It's nice to know that she's there for every company in Chicago.
Paige also attracts established ballet stars to Chicago. Mikhail Baryshnikov has called her school one of the top four in the country. He takes a class there whenever the American Ballet Theater is in town. That, too, gives Paige's students inspiration. Larry Long says it's all part of her commitment to Chicago dance, a commitment he says hasn't wavered since Paige first came here in 1919.
The number of artists that she has promoted from Chicago who've gone on to international careers has been incredible. No matter what we think, Chicago is still not the hub of American dance. New York City still is. However, I think more and more people are beginning to realize that Chicago is one of the best places to start. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Ruth has just been here. She's never given up on Chicago.
And Chicago hasn't given up on Ruth Page. Now she truly is a part of the city, as officials hang the Ruth Page Place sign in the neighborhood Page adopted as her home nearly 70 years ago. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Voodoo is more than a primitive superstition. It's the focus for creative and beautiful art. That's the premise of Spirit and Image, an unusual exhibit this month at Chicago's School of the Art Institute. The school's gallery gives such a vivid picture of the Haitian religious experience that as visitors gaze at altars strewn with glittering artifacts, they can almost hear the drum beats and chants of a real voodoo ritual. Marge Halperin takes us on a tour. In the villages of Haiti, natives turn to the gods for help with everyday problems. They beat cowhide drums, unfurl shimmering sequined flags, and shake beaded rattles to gather first the mortals, then the gods, to a ceremony meant to heal all earthly ills.
Whether it's the twins, and implied in that of the infant children is fertility, whether it's love through the Urzules coming down, whether it's the idea of getting more power and then Ogun comes down, and you can kind of draw off of his power, or whether it's the idea of dealing with the ancestors through death and the concept of regeneration with the Baron Samedi or the Geddes. All of those ranges of those concerns then become tangible when those gods come down.
Anthropologist Marilyn Holberg, co-curator of the Spirit and Image exhibit, says the gods come down to a ceremonial altar, like the one that serves as a focal point in this gallery. At the base are plates of food and lacy designs sprinkled on the floor with cornmeal. These are a sort of coat of arms representing specific gods the natives want to meet and are used as an engraved invitation. On the altar itself, decorated with beads and sequins, or left clear to show dolls crammed inside, are liquor bottles of all shapes and sizes.
Some of them have removable tops. They'll screw off and everything. And then the favored liquid of that particular god that is symbolized in the color sequins on the outside, or the pattern, you'll see one there, Dambala, the snake, the rainbow serpent god that came from the fawn of West Africa, and the favorite drink of Dambala would go in there, and since he's a very cool type of spirit, it would be something that would not be strong drink. It would probably be something perhaps like a fruit drink or something that would be not highly volatile as far as hot rum or something like that.
Once the gods arrive, Holberg says, they slip inside an available body, possessing one of the natives to join the ceremony. But Haitians don't need that elaborate ritual to contact the gods. They can do it with the help of a voodoo doll. Here at Chicago's School of the Art Institute, there's a table full of those dolls, but not one wears the cruel voodoo pins we see in the movies. Holberg says the dolls are not evil icons, but generic figures meant to show the gods the good life the makers seek. The Haitians will pray for favors and leave the dolls as a reminder, or even wrap the dolls in a letter that spells out their specific request.
What you want to do is get to where the spiritual action is and get your own request in. Usually it's something positive that you want to happen for yourself. And so you might go out then with one of these dolls and use it as a messenger, in essence.
And what are they made out of?
Well, they're just, they're stuffed with cotton and maybe sometimes old cloth. They, as you see here, some of the colors, red, black. They tend to be either male or female, and that's made quite clear usually.
They're anatomically correct.
Anatomically correct, but it doesn't matter how schematic they are. What they have to do is deliver their messages. That's the most crucial thing.
These dolls are strictly business. Their crude shapes and unadorned bodies pale next to the glittering paquettes or sachets used to call the gods to a sick bed. They are filled with healing leaves and decorated with satin ribbons, beads, sequins, and feathers. Holberg says that's more in keeping with the artistic theme of a voodoo ritual.
All of this material is available in the main market in Port-au-Prince. So there still is a sort of French legacy of fancy things, you know? Perfumes are very important to the gods. goddesses in particular. If you know you're going to a ceremony to honor a goddess of love, you'd usually make a stop in the perfume shop. You know, so I've actually had the fun experience of trying to deliberate whether, you know, Cacherelle, Anais would be more for, you know, more appropriate than other kinds of perfumes, you know. So as my daughter, once we were trying to pick out perfumes, and she said, Mom, if you were a goddess, how would you like a mere mortal interfering with your, you know, sacrifice, you know, get that expensive one. So we did relent and do that. And then afterwards she said, you know, I've never been shopping for a goddess before.
Throughout this explanation, students from this prestigious school look over Holberg's shoulder. She knows many question this exhibit, wondering if it really belongs in an art school. Holberg has no such doubts.
Some might say, well, can we really talk about real art and sequins in the same breath, you know? But I say, yes, you certainly can. And we want them to see that all that glitters is sequin flags, yes.
Anthropologist Holberg collaborated with artist Park Chambers to set up this voodoo exhibit. It's Chambers who first thought these artifacts belonged in a gallery. He even painted the walls a flat black to offset the shimmering voodoo flags. They seem to float along the surface just as they float through the air when the natives wave them to signal the start of a new ceremony.
When you see these objects in motion, they come alive in a different way. And there's a whole inner dynamics between the objects and the participants, much as we have in performance or theater or dance, and they all become interrelated and act together.
So this is their art form?
Yes, it's a total art form from beginning to end, as well as, you know, from object to the actual movement of those objects through space and time.
Like Holberg, Chambers has heard murmurs from disbelievers of this art form, but he's also seen them come around as they're absorbed in the glittery display.
I think they're more startled at seeing objects like this as art, rather than expecting the typical association of voodoo, dark images and things like that. And they do function as art, and people read them that way when they approach the gallery, and are really delighted to see that there are artifacts from this culture and not just a mumbo-jumbo religious thing going on.
Spirit and Image, a display of voodoo artifacts, is at Chicago's School of the Art Institute Gallery through Saturday and will reopen in an expanded form at the UCLA Cultural History Museum next year. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. A unique cultural center is nestled in the hills of eastern Kentucky. Apple Shop, the Appalachian Workshop, gives the locals a chance to explore the arts in the context of their own rich culture. Appalachians who may have never been to a theater are now writing their own plays. Others are making films, exploring photography, and recording songs. All use their medium to tell the story of their mountain lives. And occasionally, Apple Shop goes on tour to bring that story to the outside world. This month, the tour stopped in Chicago, where reporter Marge Halperin learned organizers of this cultural center once shunned the very art they now promote. Back in the 1960s, some well-meaning folks decided the children of Appalachia could broaden their horizons and earn passage out of the depressed area by learning a trade in the arts. Armed with federal grants, a crew descended on the small mountain town of Whitesburg in eastern Kentucky. They rounded up teenagers who wanted to learn about art East Coast style. Dudley Cott, current director of Apple Shop's theater company, says that plan didn't have a chance of success.
The kids never really bought into the program. They just started making pictures about what was right around. The dirt car races, a Sunday afternoon at the swimming pool, hog butchering that their grandfather or relative might do. And what was exciting about it was that the kids saw that the pictures they were making had a lot more reality and meaning to them than the pictures that they saw in the Hollywood movies, than they saw in the comic strips. So they just found that made that discovery that they could make their own pictures about who they were and that place.
So the grant money for job training slipped away, but the photography lived on. The teenagers' work was good enough to fund the cultural center they really needed, one that would help them explore their own heritage, and Apple Shop opened its doors. What had been done with pictures was over the years duplicated in other media, film, TV, radio, and records. In 1975, Koch launched Apple Shop's Roadside Theater Company. Its productions weave local stories and songs to paint a vivid picture of Appalachian life.
You know I can smell my mama's fried chicken. Sunday after church, folks all stopping by.
We wanted to make a theater out of our own traditions, which were storytelling and a strong music tradition, a lively church tradition, and a lot of oral history. A lot of our history is still passed along mouth to mouth. And so by using our own traditions, we've made our theater.
When Roadside performs in Appalachia, the stories are often so real that someone in the audience will pipe up with editorial comments.
What they see on the stage is their own story being told. And so at the end, when we're finished, sometimes they'll stand up and folks will say to the rest of the audience, well, I'm not throwing off on these actors. They're good actors, but it's my story. I lived through it. Come talk to me.
Even when the company performs away from home, the audience is drawn into the stories of simple Appalachian life. Koch says the actors speak with an almost universal common sense.
I remember a psychiatrist after the show stood up in the front row, turned around and addressed the audience and said, if we had more of this, I wouldn't need to work. As a psychiatrist. And in New York once in the lobby, I remember we were performing off-Broadway and we heard one theater-goer turn to the other and say, they've got those Appalachian accents the best I've ever heard. So it's you know, real varied. But you know, people seem to find part of their own story in what we're doing. So that's why we come and do it here.
The Roadside Theater's Chicago performances are part of Apple Shop's touring multimedia show, painting a picture of Appalachian life with films, photo exhibits, and two plays written by Kentucky native Ron Short. South of the Mountain and Leaving Egypt follow the story of a mountain family, Short's own family, forced by the economy to spread out, losing its men first to federal work camps, then to the coal mines.
I never liked the idea of my youngins moving off. They're going to work in them coal mines. But they wasn't nothing I could do about it. Once they knowed about all them things they didn't have, it's too late. It's not what you got. It's what you're satisfied with.
What do you see of my grandmother? I hope you see who she was, a proud, a mountain woman that raised her family the best as she could and made some hard choices and tried to do the best that she could for her family. And in thinking that, you see the pride that she took in the way that they turned out, however they turned out. She says children are different from their parents. But you know what you know, and that's the way it is.
You know what you know. It's kind of like that little story about Adam and Eve. Now, it wasn't the apple that got them in trouble. It's what they knowed after they eat it. And they ain't no turning back from that.
I wrote this play this way because of the kind of play that is a very simple family history. Because there are people in where I come from who have no family history. They have no place in history, you know? They are people who get left out. And it occurred to me that there were important people in my family. My grandmother, my father, my mother, these are important people in this world. If somebody doesn't tell their story, then I figured nobody was going to do it. And I figured maybe it was up to me. But in looking at that, I realized that in telling their story, I was telling everybody's story. I was giving everybody at home a fair shake.
Playwright Ron Short has given Appalachians something else, a chance to sort out their lives by watching them played back on stage. Through Short's eyes, the audience sees life as a series of changes, of forces beyond control dealing out one wild card after another.
Look at me. Look at me. I'm a writer. Jesus, you know. A lot of my family couldn't even write. So, things change. And that's what this story is about, changes in life and people trying to learn to live with those changes and adapt and still stay human.
Ultimately, the message from Roadside Theater and from the rest of the Apple Shop media is a sense of pride in oneself and in one's home, wherever that home may be. Ron Short says the Appalachians who learn about their heritage through Apple Shop help strengthen the local cultural tradition.
I inherited all the traditions that had come before me, and I hope to the Lord I'm adding to them. Because if I'm not, then I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. You know, I'm not adding the next layer. Because then I expect the people that come along after me to add more layers, you know, and build and build and build.
We start out here with a song that talks about home. And it could be your home or just about anybody's at all, I guess. But in this case, it's sort of about ours.
Tell me, where do you come from? And tell me, where will you go? To them mountains around you, oh, them cities of gold.
And Apple Shop continues to build, no longer seeing the need to teach the locals about more established art forms. Apple Shop now helps Appalachians spread the word about their own unique cultural heritage. The multimedia presentation in Chicago continues through the end of this month. From there, the Roadside Theater moves on alone to perform in Philadelphia. In Chicago, I'm Marge Halperin for National Public Radio. In baseball, the umpire's hand signals are a specialized sign language, a code read by players and by millions of fans. The man responsible for this language may well have been William Ellsworth Hoy, one of the first hearing-impaired players in the majors, known as Dummy Hoy, when he played at the turn of the century. Reporter Marge Halperin tells us Hoy's story was unearthed with a new play that premiered in Chicago this month, The Signal Season of Dummy Hoy.
Jimmy! What happens if you hit batter with a pitch?
You get respect.
Maybe that's the case in Fond du Lac, Jimmy, but in this league, you hit a batter, he's on first.
You're kidding.
No, they're taking all the fun out of the game.
Well, this
the year was 1886. Baseball was just beginning to become a respectable game. 24-year-old William Hoy decided it was time to give up the cobble shop he ran in Ohio to pursue the sport despite his total deafness. Hoy landed a job as center fielder for the Oshkosh, Wisconsin team at a whopping $100 for the season.
William Hoy was a remarkable man and lived 99 years, and his whole life was remarkable, not just his baseball career. So we had to decide where we were going to put our story, in what time frame, and as a matter of fact, the play takes place within the first probably 2 or 3 months of his first season in professional baseball.
Michael Nowak, co-writer of The Signal Season of Dummy Hoy, says the only thing that stood in Hoy's way was on-field confusion, as he was forced to read the umpire's lips for every call. The audience for Nowak's play shares Hoy's frustrations, as actor Dean Patrick Canavino brings the character to life. Also profoundly deaf, Canavino says he didn't have to create much of this character's life, he lives it himself. As he does in the play, Canavino speaks through a female interpreter.
As a baseball player, with a team shouting against the umpire or they shout for their hit, I'm really not sure what they say. I'm lost. So I'm sure I really do understand how Dummy Hoy really felt as a first-year professional baseball player, I really do identify with him.
And so can the audience, which shares Hoy's triumph as the umpire in this story finally agrees to use hand signals. But that's not where this story ends, nor is it the end of the influence of the hearing impaired on professional ball. Cut to the play's final scene. Dateline, Cincinnati, 1961. William Hoy is about to take center field once again, this time to throw out the first ball in a World Series game. Behind the scenes, though, there's a glitch. And in the time it takes to get the ceremony started, radio play-by-play announcers get their own hand signals. Stage managers gesture and mime Hoy's story to help fill airtime.
Actually, he was called Dummy because that's what deaf ball players were called at that time. What do you know? He insists on being called Dummy to this day.
They didn't know much about Hoy in 1961, and Hoy still isn't getting the recognition playwright Michael Nowak thinks he deserves.
It's a shame, really, that the man who created the signs for the umpires, a fellow who batted 288 lifetime, stole nearly 600 bases, was 14 years in the major leagues when there wasn't much sensitivity toward the hearing impaired or any kind of handicap. Why is this man not in the Hall of Fame? We don't understand.
It just might happen. At the request of this cast, the Hall of Fame Committee is considering such an honor for next year, the 100th anniversary of Hoy's debut in the major leagues. In Chicago, I'm Marge Halperin for National Public Radio. In a Chicago neighborhood today, not even a steady rain dampened the spirits of the Wellington Old Glory Marching Society, a group that believes parades are for marchers, not for watchers. Marge Halperin reports.
The official word from parade headquarters is we are going to march.
Yay!
And Jesse's drummers are getting out of the van. They're getting ready to set the beat. And we will just march between the raindrops.
There were no high school bands, no elaborate corporate floats, and no mob of glad-handing politicians, a real surprise for a Chicago parade. This is a neighborhood event. The organizers and the marchers are all from Chicago's north side. They include current neighbors and residents who may have moved long ago, but always come home for the parade. This 24th annual Old Glory Parade was run by Tony Weissman, carrying on a tradition started by his father.
There's always the traditional big city parades downtown. But they're always a little intimidating, and you have to stand behind a police barricade, and there's lots of floats and bands going by, and I think every child's dream is to be out there in the parade, and I think that all comes through when we march down Sheridan Road and you see the gleam in the children's eyes and they realize, hey, I really am in the parade.
And the kids marched with their heads held high despite a pouring rain.
I've always gone to this ever since I was pretty little, and I like going here no matter. I wouldn't care if there's a tornado going here, I'd love to.
Is it better than the parades you visit downtown?
You get to march in this one, and then we stand on the side getting your feet stepped in all the other ones.
Amid the wagons decorated with soggy crepe paper, the baby buggies protected by plastic, and the brightly colored umbrellas was a reminder that the true purpose of this holiday is to remember our nation's war dead. A young biker carried a sign reading, In Memoriam for the USS Stark. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Host intro. Quick, name three great American landscape photographers. Chances are, if you can think of any beyond Ansel Adams, they are all male. Traditionally, landscape photography has been a male-dominated field, but women have been taking pictures of the land, and in Chicago, a small exhibition draws together 100 photos taken by 26 of the nation's best female landscape photographers. Reporter Marge Halperin tells us a walk through the exhibit called Reclaiming Paradise, American Women Photograph the Land, seems to redefine the landscape genre. In the tradition of Ansel Adams, many male landscape photographers offer us majestic views, a glimpse of nature captured by the camera's eye, but untouched by human hands.
When female photographers view the world, however, they often give us a more intimate picture. According to Gretchen Garner, the photographer who curated this exhibit for the University of Minnesota's Tweed Museum of Art, she points out that when photographers were first commissioned to chronicle the landscape in the 19th century, the job was too rugged for most women and the primitive equipment too heavy. By the 1950s, Garner says, cameras had modernized, but attitudes had not.
Women were less liberated in the 50s than they had been earlier in the 30s and the 20s, and they studied with a man because there were very few women teaching, and without it ever being articulated, they were more or less being taught to imitate pictures that were expressive of a male point of view. And so it was very hard, I think, to surface and to find oneself. And I think the few that did it strongly, like Jerry Sharp or Marian Patterson, did a very difficult thing.
Garner says that women of the 50s were rooted in a domestic role and took domesticated pictures of their environment. It's her theory that a scene doesn't have to be entirely rustic to be considered a landscape. Women take pictures, she says, wherever they find themselves.
They see a very close connection with nature. Linda Connor, who's one of the photographers in the show, has said, "We are nature, so why venture very far?" And so you find a lot of domestic scenes, not the miles away view of Yosemite, but maybe the view of your neighbor's backyard.
Many of the pictures in this exhibit include people. Often the artist photographed herself. Judy Dater lies nude across a bed of rocks in her self-portrait with petroglyph, the petroglyph being a squiggly line across the rocks that seems to emerge like an umbilical cord from between her legs. Dater is not alone in using nature as a metaphor for the female body. Curator Garner points to the work of Jerry Sharp, who in the 1950s was an assistant to Ansel Adams. Many of Adams' best shots, Garner says, reportedly were taken by putting his tripod where Jerry Sharp's had just been. But Sharp's work takes a decidedly more feminine view of the world. For example, Garner says Sharp's picture of a cavernous driftwood form seems to be a female image that would never have been reproduced through Ansel Adams' lens.
For him, it would most likely be a formal exercise that had to do with form, light, texture, and a kind of a brilliance of presentation. Whereas for Jerry Sharp, it's a strongly felt and instantly recognized personal metaphor. Women tend to work in metaphor, men tend to work in description.
Other photographers in the Reclaiming Paradise exhibit put an even more vivid female stamp on their work. Barbara Crane works bits of lace and other sewing notions into her shots, while Betty Hahn actually sews right onto the photograph.
Betty has put her photographic images on cloth and embroidered them in a very traditional female craft with the little French knots and the satin stitch and the chain stitch that we all learned when we were in the sixth grade or something. And she's made them a little bit better, made them a little bit more colorful and playful than they were before.
What do you think she's doing with this picture of a family in front of the lilac bush?
I think she's making a comment on the kind of dumbness of most snapshots, the three people in the middle with their knees locked and standing in front of the lilac bush, squinting into the sun. So she's made an aesthetic object out of it by putting these little purple knots all over the bush, and she's made that something that really was kind of a dull picture, a delightful picture by embroidering it.
In this exhibit, even pictures without such feminine embellishment or without actual women in the scene carry the stamp of a female photographer. Prime examples are Gail Scoff's Utah Blues and the mammographic Yellow Mound. Both are shot in Death Valley.
They're very strongly metaphoric images that recall more the human body, the folds and the kind of the heaving life of a human body than they do any specific place. Gail's view is more intimate than the traditional view would be. The color is also not natural color, it's color that she's painted on the photographs. For instance, the yellow that she emphasizes one rather breast-like form with didn't exist in nature. She added that.
Garner sees those works and the others in this exhibit through the eyes of a photographer. She has not included her own photos here, though, preferring instead to use this opportunity to publicize some of her role models, of which a female photographer seems to have very few. Through this publicity, Garner hopes to broaden the definition of her genre so that the art history books might make room for a few women in the pages now filled with the photography of such men as Ansel Adams and Minor White.
My real goal for the show is to expand people's ideas of what a landscape can be. A landscape can be a picture that's really a relevant contemplation of our relationship to our environment and to environmental issues and what it means to live on this earth. And I think that the women bring a multitude of new approaches that can expand a genre that's really quite tradition-bound and kind of boring, really. I think landscape can be a lot more interesting when these pictures are included.
The exhibit Reclaiming Paradise, American Women Photograph the Land, is on display at the Chicago Public Library's Cultural Center through August 22nd. From there, it travels to the North Dakota Museum of Art in Grand Forks, to Bowling Green, Houston, Wichita, and Greencastle, Indiana. Curator Gretchen Garner says several dates on her three-year schedule are still open. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Producing an average of 100 paintings a year, Pablo Picasso gave us a generous look at his creative genius, but he was very private about how he explored and developed that creativity, working constantly in sketchbooks that he shared only with a few close friends. After Picasso died, his family agreed that the public should see the inner workings of this important artist, and an exhibition of some 200 sketchbook drawings is now traveling across the country, headed for Phoenix, Fort Worth, Fort Lauderdale, and Boston, before beginning a 7-city European tour. Reporter Marge Halperin caught the show at the Art Institute of Chicago. Teenagers keep diaries. Writers often pour out their hearts in the grown-up version, personal journals, and many artists chronicle their lives in sketchbooks. By lining up Picasso's sketchbooks in historical order, this exhibition tells the story of the artist's personal and creative life in a way no biography can.
It's like being very close to the fire of his creativity without any armor. These, in effect, are conversations with himself, and I think it's a distinct language that is not really translatable into words, but it is the experience of seeing that is most important. It is not a verbal language at all.
Peter Boris is associate director of New York's Pace Gallery, which put together this exhibition, drawing from the nearly 200 sketchbooks Picasso left to various family members. Some had been photographed in part for other shows, but this is the first time a lifetime sampling of Picasso's sketches are on display in a single exhibition. Viewers are quickly struck by the way Picasso would tackle a theme from all angles. We see, for instance, a cubist rendition of a harlequin strumming his guitar alongside a very traditional line drawing of the same pose. Douglas Druick, curator of the Chicago exhibition, says the sketches are usually dated, showing how quickly Picasso could move from one idea to another.
He could keep a number of balls in the air at the same time. He could simultaneously explore a number of themes. He could simultaneously work in a number of quite disparate styles, all of which were his own. They are all facets of the same stone.
Other times, Picasso seems to be playing with a theme as an emotional outlet rather than as artistic exercise. Druick points to a series done while Picasso's romance with artist Dora Maar was disintegrating.
You see her here. She's got these tiny little teeth and this sort of very large nose. He said it was the nose of his dog of the period. And then from one page to the next, we see a calmer, more feminine Dora Maar. Two pages later, Dora Maar has been transformed into a death's head, so that the ambiguities in their relationship are reflected in the evolution, in the evolution as we turn from one page to the next. A few pages later on, she becomes Dora Maar covered with flowers.
Picasso's sketchbooks also show the influence of other artists. A series of more than 24 drawings done in response to Manet's Déjeuner Célèbre begins with Manet's basic format, then takes us through the creative process as over time the scene evolves into some classic Picasso imagery.
The Manet is about men sitting on the grass having a bohemian lunch and a bottle of wine, and their friend, their model, has taken off all her clothes and she's sitting naked. When he starts out on the 17th of June, it's his interpretation of the Manet. By the time we get to the 1st of August, it is a rather pornographic and very raunchy bacchanal. It's as if time has gone by, everyone's drunk their wine, and everyone has taken off their clothes. He doesn't copy an artist the way some artists do copy each other. He recreates the theme so that he, in fact, personalizes and makes it his own. He almost eats it. He devours it.
From time to time, Picasso also used his sketchbooks to crack a visual joke, as in a simple drawing of a bull, which Durick found in the middle of a series of bullfight sketches.
He depicts the bull, and in the very center of the sheet, in the center of the bull, bullseye is the bullseye, and he's depicted the bullseye like a target with, in the center, the bullseye. I mean, with a very few lines, he's able to convey great wit, also great emotion. I mean, he's... With the very least, he can convey the very most, and some of the sketchbook sheets are really indeed very amusing and charming.
It's as if these jokes were tucked in to surprise historians. Though Picasso guarded his sketchbooks carefully while he lived, he surely knew they'd eventually be on exhibit. He even numbered many of the drawings, showing his exact progression on a given day. And though the viewer sometimes feels like an intruder reading private diaries, the Pace Gallery's Peter Boris thinks Picasso wanted the works to be public.
I think you make art for an audience. And when he was alive, it was certainly his privilege, and he did what he wanted. He kept them private. Now, I don't think, I think he would be pleased that they're still powerful, in a sense. While he's in his grave for 15 years, he still has the power to come out and to be magic again, and that's exactly what these do.
As a collection, Picasso's sketchbooks show an artist driven by his work like an athlete in training. He produced an incredible volume of drawings in a variety of themes and styles. Following him on that pursuit gives the viewer a most intimate look at a genius at work. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. It was in 1880 that the first sewing machine was made to assemble books, and the industry has been automated ever since. But the art of hand-binding books is still alive, practiced by perhaps 1,000 people around the country. At Chicago's Northwestern University Library, book preservationists take needle, thread, and paste to the school stacks, lovingly repairing and remaking history. Marge Halperin reports on how it's done. Richard Frieder gives new meaning to the term bookworm. As head of Northwestern University's Book Preservation Department, he carries a love of books to an extreme.
Virtually every time I pick up a book, whether it's in a bookstore or in someone's house or in a library, the first thing I do is look at it and see how it was bound and get a feel for what date it was manufactured and think, well, what kind of binding techniques were being used at that time. I do that all automatically. I don't really think about it.
And then you decide if you want to take it home and read it.
Right, yeah.
Frieder was an ideal choice when Northwestern was looking for someone to start up a book preservation department 2 years ago. As a research institution, Northwestern considers books one of its most valuable resources. But some 15,000 of those books fall apart each year, needing repairs or entire makeovers. In the book conservation lab, a crew of 9 sits at a long table, sewing, pasting, and smoothing new bindings. Scott Keller, who runs the lab, pulls from his workbench an 1857 Farmer's Almanac, which recently got the works.
It was a hardback book with a blind-stamped cloth binding, and it was taken apart into individual leaves, washed and mended, and then sewn. Then a cover was made using unbleached Irish linen, which had been colored to be sympathetic with the original binding.
By pasting the old cloth cover onto the new linen, Keller has preserved the historical context of the book itself as well as its printed message. And after some 20 hours' work, a brighter, sturdier version of the almanac is going back to the library stacks. Some modern-day machinery made the process easier than when the book was first bound. A giant paper cutter slashes pages and covers to size. There's a gold stamper to letter titles evenly. And to preserve the most fragile documents, there's the ultrasonic welder for polyester encapsulation. Loosely translated, that's a $12,000 machine that seals each page of a document or book in polyester film. This flexible material makes it safe to put even the most brittle page back into library circulation. The encapsulator is especially valuable when preserving documents from the 1800s, when highly acidic paper was used, making the pages very brittle. Often that problem can be corrected without sealing the pages. It's cheaper to give the books a bath in a special solution that neutralizes acid. The soaking also brightens yellowed pages, though Richard Frieder scoffs at hand binders who use bleach to make old pages look new. That's a technique usually used in production-oriented bookshops, which is where Frieder got his start in this business.
They tend to be more interested in a cosmetic job, something that's going to help the book sell. At least in my experience, if there's a structural problem with a book dealer may ask a binder to simply patch it together, make it look good, and make it hold together so that it can be sold.
That's not to say the university always ignores the potential market value of its hand-bound books. This department's first project was to rebind a set of 2-by-3-foot gilt-edged James Audubon prints, which were a gift to the school. Officials are pleased to point out that a dramatic display of that 4-volume set has earned the library more valuable donations. But most of the hand-binding done here is less spectacular mending, work aimed at helping scholars, not at pleasing wealthy benefactors. And Richard Frieder never lets a few moments of glory blind him to the real purpose of his job.
Books were made to be used. With the 3 million books that are in the library, I think that's the way it ought to be. A few of them were made to be looked at and considered as art objects or examples of craftsmanship, but for the most part, they were meant to be used.
For those who want to explore the few books bound as art, the Northwestern Library and members of a local bookbinders club have put together an exhibition of their finest work. It ranges from traditional leather-bound books to a hand-knitted mohair volume and a balsa wood and string book. Neither has room for printed pages, but both help prove a hand binding can be worth 1,000 words. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Our Town, the Thornton Wilder play about life, death, and the simple but meaningful moments in between, is now a musical. This show is so popular with high schools and other amateur companies that it may well be the nation's most often produced play. But the musical version, called Grover's Corners, had a difficult time getting to the stage at all. Marge Halperin has more on the making of this musical, which had its world premiere in a suburban Chicago dinner theater last week. It's never easy to turn a drama into a musical, but the team that tackled Our Town seems to be as well qualified as any. Writer Tom Jones and lyricist Harvey Schmidt are authors of such hits as The Fantastics and I Do, I Do. Our Town was originally produced in 1938, but it wasn't until 1983 that Thornton Wilder's estate freed up the rights to adapt the show. Jones and Schmidt did the job in just 3 months, but after a stream of backers' auditions, they realized they wouldn't be able to find a producer willing to mount the show in New York.
Our Town is not the kind of Broadway musical being done in this era of shows like Cats and Starlight Express and Les Miserables. These are all very big, expensive imports, and that's what's going on Broadway at the moment.
Lyricist Schmidt says Grover's Corners was rescued by the Alliance of American Theater Producers, including Carrie Walker, producer at Marriott's Lincolnshire Theater in suburban Chicago. Walker says this is the group's first independent production.
We're all out here in Chicago and in L.A. and San Diego and Houston and Tampa, and we all have seasons, and we have to do 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 shows a year every year. the number of shows produced in New York annually has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and simultaneously has been moving toward spectacle, 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 shows that don't travel easily. And after you've done South Pacific for the 13th time, you know, there starts to be a problem, and this is one of our first attacks on this problem.
Our town is an ordinary town in almost every way. Our town is filled with ordinary people, at least that's what they say.
Grover's Corners would seem to be tailor-made for the non-New York venue, even though Jones and Schmidt didn't have regional theaters in mind when they wrote this show. First, it's short. While Our Town is sometimes a three-hour play, Grover's Corners runs just 1 hour and 40 minutes, including 14 musical numbers. Jones says it gives an audience a full range of Our Town emotions and still lets the matinee crowd get home in time to beat rush hour traffic. The musical also has a smaller cast than Our Town, and in this production, the orchestra has only 11 pieces. The setting has changed, too. While Our Town is a nostalgic visit to the turn of the century, the musical is updated a bit.
The place is Grover's Corners, New Hampshire. The time is between the two great wars. The first part shows some fragments and moments of a typical day in our town. Well, better show you the way our town lies.
The basic problem with any musical, according to writers Jones and Schmidt, is trying to strike a balance between stuffy pretense and cheap sentimentality. With a script like Our Town, it was the sentimentality that was the hardest to avoid. Director Dominic Massimi says most of his audience will already have seen an overacted, amateur version of this story, and he worked closely with his cast to keep this show natural.
For example, a line is that the boy says, George, the leading character, says, he looks at Emily and he says, I've always thought of you as one of the chief persons I've always thought of. And he's very uncomfortable. Now, a young actor, or an actor maybe without a director who's watching that, could be very, very coy and do all of the sort of pulling at the shirt, knees knocked in, looking like a Norman Rockwell, some of those cute little kids that you always saw on his covers. And that's an example where you just have to make sure that the actor is coached to say, read it honestly, read it how you really feel it. Don't play the line. Don't play the ending.
And that was when you said that for a whole year I wasn't noticing people? And why you, for instance? You said you was watching me when I did everything. I was doing the same thing to you all along.
Really?
Why, sure. I always thought about you as one of the chief people I thought about. Sometimes when it is so.
It's too early to say whether this show succeeds as the honest, simple story of life and death that Thornton Wilder set out to tell. The tricky part is the final scene. There, the leading lady, Emily, walks to her grave. The play flashes from her wedding to her funeral, and the narrator tells us she's just 26 years old, having died in childbirth. Some critics object to the musical's treatment of that graveyard scene. One local reviewer's headline screamed, Grover's Corners Market on overkill. But Chicago Tribune critic Sid Smith thinks that's too harsh a judgment.
It's blown up, but I don't think it's overkill. I mean, that's sort of a musical's job, is to make something thunderous and stirring. The original final act of Wilder is power-packed with a complexity of emotions. They're not trying to make you wring your handkerchief the entire way through the end. They're trying to make you attuned to what Wilder's all about, and it's a mixture of grief, but finally surrender and acceptance and some kind of recognition of spirituality.
And this moment now is the only one we own. Time goes by. Time goes by.
Writer Tom Jones insists he doesn't care what any of the critics say. After 4 years of peddling his story from one reluctant producer to another, he's finally decided that this is a real show for real people, and it's their opinion he's waiting for.
I think this is some of the best work we've ever done, maybe the best work we've ever done. And it looked for a while as if it was never going to come to judgment before real people. The great thing is that we're going to be allowed to put it in front of an audience. And if they like it a lot, then it'll just grow and whatever. And if they don't like it at all, it'll just crawl to the, under the kitchen stove and die like a domestic animal.
Already, Grover's Corner seems to have more lives than a domestic cat. A dozen theaters around the country have scheduled this show. And if those productions are successful, the play may yet end up in New York, despite the big-shot producers who predicted it would never see a stage. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
11 o'clock in Grover's Corners. Everybody's in bed. You get a good rest, too.
Time goes by. Time goes by.
Chicago is bailing out of its heaviest rainfall in 30 years. Marge Halperin reports more than 9 inches of rain has fallen since 9 o'clock last night. One. Floods turned O'Hare Airport into an island, shutting down the highway and mass transit line leading there.